Good afternoon, everybody. We're now moving into the bearded guy portion of the panel, and so we're glad that you're sticking around. I'm talking about a different topic, but one that I think that I hope you'll find interesting, and it's based on some work that I've been doing over the past couple of years with the Michigan Department of Community Health, looking at trying to develop guidance to make ethical decisions to allocate scarce medical resources and services during public health emergencies. And so, you know, as we've all been, oh, I should mention, no conflicts of interest, but some of the work done on this project was funded by the Michigan Department of Community Health. I'm going to first talk a little bit about some of the reasons why this project was started and some of the underlying assumptions that we made in coming up with guidelines to deal with scarce resource allocation during emergencies. And then I'll talk about some of the substance of the recommendations themselves, what goals we're trying to achieve, the ethical considerations we're taking into account, the allocation criteria that we recommend, and finally talking about some implementation strategies and some legal and ethical challenges that are likely to arise in this context. So, you know, as we've all been watching over the last 2 days, the massive hurricane hitting the East Coast, it's a reminder of the unpredictability of natural disasters, certainly, but the fact that emergencies can occur in any number of ways, whether we're talking about pandemics, whether we're talking about natural disasters, whether we're talking about other kinds of large-scale events that can arise and create unique public health challenges. And one of the predictable challenges that it's likely to occur during these kinds of events is that, especially if they're massive events, if they're catastrophes with widespread destruction, that there could result shortages in any number of types of medical resources and services. And so even just looking at some of the news reports from last night in New York City, several hospitals in New York City lost power. They had to evacuate people. Now, in a large metropolitan area, a dense metropolitan area like New York City, that's not a huge problem, although it's certainly not an ideal situation, but you can move those patients to another facility and hopefully get them the care that they need or the ongoing treatment that they need. And hopefully you have capacity to deal with people who are injured by the storm itself. But you can imagine if you have devastation on the scale of something like New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, where the medical infrastructure is almost completely destroyed, or other situations like a large-scale flu pandemic where the emergency is happening all across the country or perhaps all around the world simultaneously, these shortages can be very significant, and there might not be acceptable alternatives, and we might be faced with situations where you actually have to make decisions about how you allocate the resource that you have and in circumstances where you don't have enough to serve everyone. And so, these kinds of situations can be anticipated, even for sudden events, even for unexpected events, because the general types of shortages can be anticipated. And there's been a lot of work over recent years trying to come up with good strategies, good plans to, the Strategic National Stockpile and some other initiatives trying to prevent shortages. But nevertheless, what we wanted to do in this project was to look at how you would make ethical decisions and how you would make decisions consistent with the law if you did have to allocate in a situation of scarcity. And one of our initial considerations is that emergency planners themselves have a duty to develop guidance along these lines so that if this kind of situation were to occur, there is well thought out guidance that, and you're not making it up ad hoc on the fly. A couple of other points at the outset. The kinds of legal and ethical considerations applicable during these scarcity situations in emergencies will differ from the kinds of debates that we have about everyday scarcity. I mean, our system inherently has some scarcity. But here we're talking about a really acute kind of situation with a really significant shortage that may be remedied in a couple of weeks, but at least in the interim, that there might be need to make some tough decisions. But there's also in thinking about this kind of topic, also have to keep in mind that the people who would be making allocation decisions would be at all levels, right? You'd have people, a lot of people who are providing patient care. So, you know, at the point of contact with patients in a hospital, in a public health clinic, but also people who would be making decisions at the local and state government level, and perhaps even at the federal government level. And you'd also have public and private entities all being faced with similar kinds of dilemmas about allocation. And having them come up with some kind of consistent strategy is a useful goal to try to achieve as well. One other point is that the kinds of scarcity that might arise varies. And so it may be scarcity of medications, it may be scarcity of hospital beds, it may be scarcity of personnel who are skilled to treat people in certain kinds of situations. And so all of those kinds of things should be taken into account. And finally, the kinds of ethical principles need to not just be focused on individual healthcare. You know, I don't need to explain this to people at a public health conference, but population level considerations are going to be paramount, especially when you're talking about fairly distributing and adequately distributing scarce resources across a population. These guidelines have to be consistent with the law, so that you're not putting anyone in legal jeopardy, and you're not violating legal requirements. Okay, so just a minute or two on the background of the project. The state of Michigan, as other states have been doing over the past decade, has developed a very detailed emergency response plan. There's an infrastructure, and lots of planning goes into how to respond to public health emergencies. This was a piece, though, that the state didn't have in place as of a couple of years ago, and actually very few states had really made much progress on this topic at that point, in around 2008 when we started working on this. The idea was that to create this set of guidance for all kinds of scarcity and all kinds of emergencies at all levels that would be useful across the board in all those different kinds of contexts, and would be specific to the state of Michigan, but that also would hopefully be useful, and other entities could draw from that as well. Since then, one of the more important developments in this area that recently occurred is that the IOM came out with a report about 6 months ago now on crisis standards of care, which covers a lot of the same ground. And so there's some good overlap, and I'll talk about that later if people are interested. What we did is we convened an expert committee, ethics advisory committee, with a whole range of different kinds of representation. We had healthcare providers, people who worked in emergency rooms as you know, emergency room physicians and nurses. We had representatives from the different medical associations representing different kinds of providers. We had EMS professionals. We had people from state and local public health in the room. We reached out to different groups that advocate for different population cohorts. And so we invited people who look out for pediatric interests, for the interests of the aging, and we tried to get a good diverse group of people on our committee. And then once we drafted our initial guidelines, we then sent it out very broadly around the state. And that process is still going on right now. We're in the process of doing public meetings and trying to really get widespread feedback on these guidelines. So let me tell you a little bit about the content of the guidelines and what we concluded. At the outset, we decided that we were trying to achieve three distinct goals. And none of these are inherently any more important than the other, but that we would try to achieve all these goals simultaneously with our guidance. One goal, of course, is minimizing morbidity and mortality, so making sure that that whatever approach we take is well suited to minimizing the health impact of the emergency. A second important goal is going to be maintaining the social fabric, and I would say that this actually can be stated in two different ways, or at least there are two different sub-goals underneath this goal. One way that you maintain the social fabric is by actually ensuring that the people whose skills you need to keep society functioning well are able to do that. And so what I mean by that is there are going to be some types of key essential personnel. Maybe they're people who are working in the healthcare system. Maybe they're public safety and other kinds of professionals who might keep other operations in the community running during the emergency. And so those kinds of key people, protecting them and perhaps giving them priority to scarce resources could be justifiable in order to maintain that social fabric. There's also the other side of maintaining the social fabric, which is that we have to make sure that the decisions that we're making are going to be met with, as much as possible, a level of public support, that the public continues to trust the decision makers who are making allocation decisions, whether they be at the face-to-face level for someone receiving care in a hospital, or whether they be someone at the state government making a decision about how to allocate a stockpile of resources. And so maintaining trust and making sure that decisions are made transparently and with accountability is also key to maintaining the social fabric. And finally, ensuring fairness. And it's very much related to the point I was just raising a minute ago. We want to make sure that these guidelines try to, or not just try to, but actually succeed at creating a fair process and substantively fair outcomes to the extent that that's possible. And when we say fairness, we're not necessarily talking about everyone having an equal chance of getting the scarce resource, but it's important that however we decide to make these decisions, we're making them in a way that doesn't exacerbate existing disparities in the community, that doesn't result in people getting shut out based on unfair criteria. And when I talk about the criteria in a minute, hopefully I can add a little more to that, a little more context to that statement. Okay, so one of the parts of this process was we tried to identify all of many ethical considerations that we would need to take into account to make a good ethical decision about scarce resource allocation. And so I'm not going to go through these in detail, but you can get a sense of the kinds of things we were considering. Yeah, beneficence, the duty to do good for others. Utility, having outcomes that are useful. And presumably in this context, utility would be that first goal, although, minimizing morbidity and mortality, although there would be other measures of utility as well. Both procedural and substantive fairness, so procedural justice as well as distributive justice, making sure that resources are being distributed across the population. Transparency and accountability, I already mentioned, as well as trust. Respect for persons, and then proportionality, solidarity. We're all in this together in a tough emergency situation. Reciprocity, which might also support the idea of those essential personnel having some priority access. You know, people who are out there sacrificing themselves for the good of the community might have a moral claim that we repay them in a sense for their efforts. Good stewardship of scarce resources, as well as veracity, telling the truth. And so, in the report, we go into this in a lot more detail. But I wanted to spend the bulk of my time talking about these allocation criteria, because this is where our committee ended up. These are the three categories that we ended up ratifying. I will say ratifying, but we came at least in our current draft. We came to an agreement that this was a good approach for guidance in this area. So, three categories. First, I'll talk about the acceptable allocation criteria. We think that these criteria are acceptable to use in virtually all circumstances. And those two criteria are medical prognosis of the patient who's seeking to receive the scarce resource, and essential social functions, which I'll get to more in a minute. Our second category is situation dependent. So these are criteria that might be appropriate under some circumstances, but there are some ethical concerns about using them. And so if they are to be used, they should only be used with great care and with great advanced deliberation. And those are age, lottery, and first come, first served. And then finally, we have unacceptable allocation criteria. Social characteristics, any other characteristics, that a person's gender, race, age, weight, anything that would not be connected to their medical prognosis, immediate medical prognosis, and I'll get back to that as well, and also any other kind of measurement of social worth that's not functionally related. So a person's education, a person's religious affiliation, whether you know the doctor that works in the emergency room or not, those kinds of things should not be legitimate criteria to differentiate between people and give them priority. Okay, so let me go into this in a little bit more detail. Medical prognosis. We talk about medical prognosis. We're talking about measurements of assessments of the patient's medical condition, the likelihood of a positive medical response, the relative risk of harm of not treating that patient. So, if someone is a high risk to suffer great harm if they're not treated, but also has good indicia of survivability. So, the important point here is that we're not giving priority to those who are the worst off first. It's the people who are the worst off and are likely to survive. And so this is kind of a triage model. And again, this is only justifiable if the situation is really serious and there's a significant scarcity that can't be avoided by some alternative means. Okay, our second category here for acceptable allocation criteria is essential social functions. So I mentioned before that that there might be or that there is, I think, good ethical arguments to be made. There are good ethical arguments to be made that certain essential personnel can receive priority because of the important functions they fulfill within society. And this has to be defined carefully because you don't want anyone to just be able to come up and say, well, I think I'm essential. We had lots of long conversations about who was essential in our committee, really interesting conversations, and, you know, should elected officials be considered essential? The answer was we did not recommend that, much to the chagrin of probably a lot of the elected officials. But we left it sort of open-ended because we figured a lot of it is going to be situation-dependent anyway. And so here are some examples of groups that might be included as essential personnel. So healthcare workers who are directly treating people who are affected by the emergency, and possibly some other healthcare workers who are kind of backfilling capacity within the healthcare system. And so obviously there are people with chronic conditions that are going to need ongoing care. And so those people treating them might also be considered essential healthcare workers during the emergency. People who are providing elective treatments that can wait are not going to be considered to be essential workers. Personnel who are first responders and public safety personnel might also fit in this category, as well as people who maintain critical infrastructure. We want the power grid to keep working. We want our telecommunications to keep working. And maybe we want sanitation workers to be essential personnel. So if you think about what are the critical functions and who you need to perform those functions, it can actually get into this list might end up being longer than initially you would think. And so it's actually It's a debate that policymakers need to have on this topic. Now, another thing that we tried to do is we said, well, okay, let's say you had these two categories, but you still need to differentiate within these categories. You know, how do you prioritize? You know, if you've got essential workers and you also have people with who are at risk but have a good medical prognosis. And so one of the things that we tried to do is to stratify it a little bit further and say that if you had both of those, if you fit in both of those categories, if you were an essential worker who had a high risk of severe morbidity and mortality and a favorable medical prognosis, that you would have priority, as well as if you're irreplaceable and an essential worker, or if you have high occupational exposure. Now, one big caveat here, and we had a lot of debate on our committee about this topic, which is, Do you treat all kinds of medical resources the same way? And there were some on the committee who felt that for certain kinds of resources, particularly resources that would require long-term recovery, like a ventilator during a flu pandemic, and that essential worker was not going to recover quickly enough to jump back in and start helping people again during the duration of that emergency, that then there would not be an ethical justification to give that person priority over any other person. Although others said, because of reciprocity and some other considerations, that there still would be, also that it would be an incentive for people to come to work in the first place. And so our committee was actually split on whether we should differentiate. And you know, the second tier broadens out to other groups with elevated risk and good prognosis and so on. Because I don't want to run out of time, I want to move on and talk about our three situation-dependent allocation criteria. We had age. This is obviously a really controversial potential way to differentiate between people because our committee was split right down the middle on this, and there are some who felt very strongly that all other things being equal, that age would be a good tiebreaker for people with equivalent prognoses, and that if you had an 80-year-old and an 8-year-old, the 8-year-old should clearly get preference. Of course, that logic is less easy to come to if the ages are closer. And there were a lot of people on the committee who also felt that it was inappropriate to introduce age because it's age discrimination. Not only is it probably in violation of laws that prohibit age discrimination, but also that there are ethical problems with just valuing a person based on their numerical age. So our recommendation ended up being that this is something that, if it's going to be used, it can only be used in a very careful way with extensive public deliberation, and that the legal issues need to be addressed. Lottery is another interesting question, because a lottery, if it's done completely fairly, and everyone has an equal chance, satisfies fairness, it satisfies the idea of giving everyone an equal opportunity to access the resource, but it doesn't necessarily maximize your reductions in morbidity and mortality. It also, you'd have to come up with a fairly extensive set of rules about how it would work. Could you trade your lottery number to someone else? Could you give it to a family member or a friend? What would be the rules, and how do you avoid people gaming that system? Finally, we talked about first come, first served. Now, for a lot of healthcare providers, first come, first served is easy. This is the way you normally treat people. They show up at the emergency room, you give them the resource that you need. You don't think about who's going to come in tomorrow necessarily. The first come, first served is not truly fair, because it inherently advantages people who have built-in advantages that they have, transportation, they have information, and they're going to get to the resource first because of those advantages. And so there are some problems with that as well. Let me mention quickly, because I'm out of time, unfortunately, things that we find unacceptable: social characteristics like race, gender, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, religious affiliation, disability unrelated to immediate medical prognosis. And this is very important, that we don't want disability to be considered as people. We don't want people with disabilities to be considered as having an inherently less good prognosis just because of their disability. And so we wanted to make clear that that was not acceptable either as a differentiation criteria. And finally, social worth that's not functionally related. So your job status, your education, your relationships or affiliations, and the only exception to your ability to pay. The only exception to this is that small cohort of essential personnel because of their essential role in responding. And so I'm going to stop there. If people have more questions, I can tell you a little bit more about how we're planning to finish this off and operationalize it. So thank you.